I get the opportunity to talk to people all the time about becoming sports agents, and I tell them really one simple rule. You have to be wired a certain way. You have to be ingrained that way. You know, you have to really love helping other people.
Welcome to the next episode of What's Next with Eric Wood. Our next guest is Brian Murphy. Brian is the current president of Athletes First, which has grown into the largest independent football agency in the country. Brian has helped negotiate the largest contract in NFL history on three separate occasions. He is a graduate of Notre Dame undergrad and Harvard Law School. Brian is extremely generous of his time, talent, and treasure, and has recently won two Man of the Year awards for his philanthropic efforts. He lives in Orange County, California, with his beautiful wife, Lauren, and his wonderful daughters, Brittany and Mackenzie. I was with Athletes First during my playing career, and I'm extremely grateful for how Murph and the entire roster of agents represented me throughout my career. Athletes First not only always made sure I was secure contract-wise, they also went above and beyond to support my foundation events, support my family, and provide me with some incredible experiences. I have learned so much from Murph in the 13 years I've known him, and you will be impacted by his words in this podcast. Finally, remember to subscribe, rate, and review the podcast. It really does go a long way in helping us produce great content for you. Now, enjoy the show. Murph, welcome to the show.
Thank you. Great to be here. Great to be here.
Yeah, first off, let me say, when I was preparing for this conversation, I came across a note you sent me when my career ended. And I'd be lying if I didn't say 2.5 years later, it still made me emotional. So, one, let that be a power of, let that show the power of words and what they can do for people. And that's something I learned from you a long time ago. You were always quick to send a nice note, a text, an email. And I always appreciate that about you. So thanks again for that.
It's easy. It's, as I always say, it's very easy to write great notes about great people, you know, and that's, certainly that you fit that category, and your career coming to an end was not something, your football career coming to an end was not something we anticipated coming that soon, but you know, it's great to see you moving on and continue to have a huge impact in the community.
I really appreciate that. And let's give the listeners a little bit of intro on you. Let's start off by telling the listeners where you grew up and what kind of athlete were you growing up as a kid?
I grew up outside of Boston, Massachusetts. That's why I'm a diehard sports fan, Boston sports fan. And the type of athlete I was as a kid is about the same as I am now. Horrible. Definitely got cut from my Pop Warner football team, which is almost impossible to do. And
what kind of numbers were you guys working with?
We didn't have enough really almost to field the team, but they didn't care. They're like, we'd rather go with 10, you know. And then actually, I have a picture behind me here. This article here, I tried out. I grew up in a small town, Medfield, Massachusetts, and I tried out for the basketball team four times, and I got cut four times, which is, again, hard to do. My freshman year, when I got cut, I was so despondent because I wanted to be part of it, so I went to the town newspaper, and I got a job as a sports writer, so I got to go around on the bus with a team. It was a really good team at the time. And I got to write for the town newspaper. I was a ninth grader. So kind of one of the first examples to turn lemons into lemonades. But as I look back now, like I think like what an incredible nerd I was that I, you know, was willing to write for the school paper just so I could hang out with the basketball players. But yeah, so to answer, that's not a great question to ask, but I was an awful athlete. Still am.
Well, and part of the reason I ask is because you're still active as an athlete. Like you play basketball. I've heard your buddies from California when I've come out for golf tournaments and whatnot, talk about you being effective as a basketball player. So maybe you just peaked way, way, way later in life.
Yes, I did. I still, if awards are giving out, I still get the Best Spirit Award or the Try Hard Award, never the MVP or anything like that.
Yeah, my wife always loves when I say that her senior year, she got the most inspirational award. And she always says, no, I got newcomer of the year because I transferred schools. I'm like, that's not quite how I remember it. But so
I've seen her dance, though. She's quite an athlete, that's for sure.
Yep. And you didn't see her in competitions. You just see her tearing up wedding dance floors. And I always call it her Britney Spears move. She'd be like, oh, let's go dance on the dance floor. And she starts doing these like wild hair flips and whatnot. I'm like, well, I don't really know what to do with that. So
I'll just kind of give you your space, let you do your thing. I'll go up and grab the microphone, and at some point I'll sing Should Have Been a Cowboy or something. And
we'll both
show off our talents.
No one is looking at us when our wives are dancing, and I mean that as a compliment.
No doubt. So you end up attending Notre Dame undergrad and Harvard Law School, both prestigious schools, but what made you decide on those two schools as opposed to others?
Yeah, sure. So it's actually a funny story. My dad's grandparents, Gran and Papa, I was extremely close to them growing up. They were both English teachers, and they had overcome all kinds of adversity in their life. And they made it known to me, especially my grandfather, at a very, very, very early age, that my job in the family was to go to Notre Dame and then Harvard Law School. And so my dad went to Notre Dame, my uncle went to Notre Dame. So that was pretty much preordained. And, that went fairly well. But when I applied to law school, I applied everywhere, and I got in everywhere except for Harvard out of undergrad. And so I had to go down to Cape Cod, Massachusetts, and tell my grandfather that I didn't get in. I didn't even get waitlisted. And he's like, listen, you need to put a suit and tie on and go down to Cambridge and tell them they made a mistake. And I'm like, no, that's not how it works, Papa. And he's like, you have to. So I put a suit and tie on, and which not easy at that age, and went down to Cambridge and found the director of admissions office and went in. And I'll never forget, there's four ladies sitting there, and I explained to them who I was and, you know, what my grades were, my everything like that, and how important it was to my grandfather for me to go to school, and was there any way they could reconsider? And they very politely said no, and asked me to leave. And as I was leaving, before the door shut, all four of them just burst out laughing, like complete laughing. And it was like utter embarrassment and humiliation, and they had a right to. I mean, who was I to think I could go down and see my grandpa wants me to go here? So I went to Columbia my first year of law school, and loved it, had a great time. As you can imagine, going from South Bend to Manhattan was a huge difference. Was very lucky to do very well and applied to transfer to Harvard. Got accepted and had a very difficult decision because I love Columbia. I love my friends. I knew I could do well there. But my grandparents' dream, and really became my dream, was always to go to Harvard. So, I transferred, and thank God I did, or I wouldn't be sitting here today.
Wow. That's an incredible story. And that ends up being an incredible lesson on loyalty to your grandfather and leaving the fun of the city and all that and going back home and going to Harvard. I was so close to saying, wow, what a lesson on resilience and persistence, persistency, when you went into the admissions office and said, please let me in. I put on a suit. I did everything I could. I thought that story was going to lead to them saying, yes, you're in. So ended up being a great lesson on loyalty.
Yeah, I think it was also a good lesson. They made their decision. I thought I was going to get in. They made their decision. It was obviously the right decision. So many talented people want to go there. And, you can't just, that would have been a shortcut, right? I mean, that would have been, resiliency. Yeah, we could have turned it, but it would have been a shortcut. And what I had to do is I just had to, and you've been through this on the field. I had to take it to a higher level, and what I had done up to that, I thought it was my best. And I didn't think I could do any better, but I went down to New York and I just, found a way to do better. And, at that point I did better. I improved myself as a student and as a candidate, and then I was ready to go, So it was, these things are never handed to you, just like when you left college and you went to the Bills, like first round pick or whatnot, but they're not going to just say, hey, you're the starting center, no matter how you do it, you had to bring it to another level.
Yeah, they're going to make me play guard for a year and a half, which I stunk at and got hurt at multiple times, and then let me play center. How tough of a school is Harvard? I've heard Malcolm Gladwell and a couple others talk about before that sometimes going to a school like Harvard, it's so difficult, and you're no longer that big fish in the small pond. You're a small fish in the most elite pond, the biggest pond there possibly is. Is it tough there with all the competition and the raised expectations?
Eric, I think you and I share this characteristic, and if we don't, I apologize for saying it, but throughout my whole life, I never thought I was a big fish in a small pond, even though I went to a very small high school. I thought I was, in my mind, I thought I was just lucky to get to Notre Dame, and then I thought that I was lucky to go to Harvard, and even as a sports agent, I've always just kind of thought I've been very lucky and blessed. And I know there's been hard work and talent and whatnot, but I've never wanted to be the big fish in any pond. You know, I just like to be surrounded by all the best fish. So, you know, I can improve myself. And that sounds like incredibly corny and just like I'm telling you, you know, what people want to hear. But, you know, I never had that problem, you know. And I also never really thought that there were a lot of fish bigger than me, you know, or smarter than me or whatnot. I just, you know, listen, we're all here together. I don't think we're competing against each other. We're all trying to be the best we can be. And, you know, so to me, it wasn't hard. It was exhilarating. They had a basketball court where I got to play basketball every day and try super hard again and meet a lot of friends. And I was surrounded by like the most intelligent, articulate students and professors. And, you know, probably I don't have many regrets in life because I think life unfolds the way it should. But one regret I probably have is the lack of classes I went to when I actually got into Harvard, because, you know, my girlfriend was now my wife was in that city. My family was in that city. All my boys that grew up with was in that city. So, you know, there's plenty of distractions as opposed to, you know, going to these classes with like, Professor Tribe and Professor Dershowitz. So I probably could have taken a little more advantage of it, but I didn't find it difficult. I found it exhilarating.
Yeah, I love that. And you're spot on. I feel the exact same way. I got one scholarship offer to the University of Louisville. I get it after a basketball game. I've never even been to Louisville. I end up committing there, go to a school that I had the opportunity to fit in with an offensive line early on in my career where I could start as a freshman. And that's just blind luck. It wasn't like we looked at all the different possibilities for schools and said, that's the right fit. You know, I believe I have a strong faith and I believe God put me in that situation. And, you know, now he's given me this platform and I just feel like the luckiest dude in the world, the people I'm surrounded with, the family I have. And I'm just overwhelmed by gratitude. And we definitely share that. And so you graduate Harvard Law. Did you know immediately you wanted to become a sports agent, and how did you get your in the business?
Yeah, no, I mean, like I've always, since I got cut from Pop Warner, you know, I grew up in Boston and, you know, I love Larry Bird and Kevin McHale and Robert Parrish. And there was a sports agent in Boston, one of the godfathers, his name is Bob Wolf, and he unfortunately has passed away now. But he was often in the papers, especially being Larry Bird's agent. So I always thought like, wow, that would be phenomenal, you know? But at the same time, when I came out of law school, I went to one of the top law firms in the country, Ropes & Gray. And there again, I was surrounded by the best litigators in the country. And there is no time to dream about being a sports agent. I mean, we literally worked. Like if we weren't there at 7 a.m., we're late. If we left before midnight, like they're like, what's wrong? Are you having a baby or something like that? You know what I mean? And we had a cafeteria there for three meals a day. We had a gym there to work out in, you know, a huge building in Boston. And there was never any time to think about like being a sports agent. You just go and you work and it's a 9-year partner track. So you're on this treadmill for 9 years if that's what you want to do. And I loved it. And I got all kinds of phenomenal cases. I was allowed to take on a pro bono case with my best friend who was a homeless advocate down in Atlanta. And we sued the city of Atlanta and the mayor and the police leading up to the 96 Olympics, I think it was, you know, for the treatment of homeless people. And so that was great, you know, phenomenal experience. I had another case that went to the Supreme Court where, you know, again, I was, you know, carrying briefcases and making copies, but, you know, we got to experience that. $1 billion trial over the ownership of our building, which is one of the biggest buildings bought. So I loved it. Man. And I always knew I wanted to be a sports agent, but I never really took any steps towards being a sports agent. You know, I was just doing what I love to do, and I was trying to be the best lawyer I could be.
And then how did you get your into the sports agency world?
Yeah, so great story. And this is where I meant by if I had never gone to Harvard, I would never become a sports agent. So a good friend of mine who I played basketball with at Harvard Law School, his name is Ted Ruger. Brilliant, brilliant, brilliant. He's an editor of our law review. I think he's number two in our class. Not the best basketball player, but he gave it a shot, you know. And he was supposed to go clerk for the First Circuit, you know, so a federal court right out of law school. But his lawyer, his judge that he was supposed to work for, got promoted to the Supreme Court, Justice Breyer. And you're not allowed to go from law school to the Supreme Court. And all the other federal court positions were full. So he had to go work for a year at a law firm. And so he came to Ropes & Gray. And so we continued to build our friendship at Ropes & Gray. He went and clerked a year later at the federal level. Then he went clerked 2 years at the Supreme Court. So now we're 3 years past like when we worked together. And he comes back to Cambridge to figure out what he's going to do next. And he's looking through all these job listings. And literally there was a job listing saying, you know, do you want to be the next Jerry Maguire? And thankfully he didn't, right? Because, he might be the dean of Penn Law School now. He's so much more qualified than I was. But he called me and we really hadn't talked in 3 years. He said, hey, Murph, I know you always talked about being a sports agent, you know, and there's a listing here to go work for Steinberg, Moran & Dunn. Like, I thought I'd pass it along. And so I got the number, I called, I sent my resume, and I flew out the next day for an interview, which was August. And I continued to interview for the job from August until February. And they had a whole bunch of candidates. And ironically, it came down to two candidates, myself and Rob Pelinka, who is now the GM of the Lakers. And wow. I believe that Rob took a job with Arne Tellem as a basketball agent. So I got it as default. At least that's what Dave Dunn tells me. I don't know if that's true or not, but he wants me to think I got it by default. And so I got that job in February. It was a very long process. I remember Dave Dunn telling me I had to do something to distinguish myself. So I put together a whole mock Sports Illustrated with myself on the cover saying, you know, next, the latest in line of super agents from Steinberg, Moran & Dunn. And then I wrote a whole article that was 10 years in the future. And it basically talked about where everyone that I had interviewed with would be in 10 years, including Lee Steinberg becoming the commissioner of football. So it was, I think that really distinguished me from everybody else. And I was able to get that job. And myself and my wife, Lauren, who you know well, 7 months pregnant, we left Boston. We left two good paying jobs. And we went to Southern California, Newport Beach, and took a job for $60,000 a year and lived in a back apartment and had one car and rode my bike to work.
Wow. I hope you share that with all of those that you hire at Athletes First now, because that's a phenomenal story. I love that you used your high school sports editing background yep. to then come full circle and help you get your job as a sports agent one day. Man, what an awesome story. And being a sports agent is often such a desired career for people. I know when I was training for the combine out in Orange County, I would come from workouts. We had two workouts a day. And in between, I would go hang out at the office all day long at Athletes First office. And I was convinced that when I was done playing football, I was going to go right back to Orange County. I told my wife now that we were going to eventually one day go out to Orange County because I was going to be a sports agent and I was going to work at Athletes First. I would joke about whose office I was going to take. We won't name them on this podcast. Obviously I've gone in a different direction now. I still haven't just eliminated being an agent one day completely, because being in the sports world is something that I'm definitely passionate about. But everyone sees draft day and they see the glitz and the glamour of the big contracts. But when someone, especially a former athlete, but when anybody comes to you and says, hey, I want to be a sports agent, what are the warnings you give them for the non-desirable things that they may not see as a part of the profession?
Sure. Well, first of all, that office has your name on it, and it's just waiting for you and Leslie to move out here and and join us, because you would be a phenomenal sports agent. But my guess is you have bigger and better things on your horizon. But yeah, no, I get the opportunity to talk to people all the time about becoming sports agents, and you know, I tell them really one simple rule: you have to be wired a certain way. And you know, Athletes First is the name of our company, but it's also our mission statement, and it's really, you have to be ingrained that way. You know, you have to really love helping other people. And by helping other people, that doesn't mean, you know, signing the biggest contract in NFL history all the time. You know, sometimes it means, you know, you get that call and one of your favorite clients of all time has, doing an exit physical routine and all of a sudden they have to retire, you know. Or it could be like our whole rookie class right now, you know, moving to new cities and needing to find apartments and, you know, find mattresses and find furniture and whatnot. So it's, we spend all day, every day just helping other people. And it's, I love it. I mean, I love it. And as you know, I also have a whole team led by Savannah who does most of the work, right? Cause they're so good at it. And, I love being able to help people come out of college and have an influence on every part of their life. And so when they think of Murph and his team and Athletes First, you know, we become an integral part of their life, you know, and probably no one personifies that more than, you know, your primary agent, you know, Cameron Hahn, you know, who, like, he started off as your agent, you know, and, you know, did all that stuff for you. Didn't dress you very well for your press conference, but other than that, you know, did everything for you. And now I'd say, you know, he's probably a much better friend to you than he ever was an agent. And he was as better, you know, as good of an agent as you can be. So, you know, I tell people, this is not about, you cannot get into being a sports agent for yourself. And I think that's the one thing that everyone at Athlete First really does very well. It's never about us. You know, we certainly we'll do this podcast and I'll talk about myself and about our company, but as even that is supposed to be to help others and you know, always put the athletes first or other people first. And if you like that, if you like not being the main attraction, if you like helping other people, then this is a job for you for sure. But if you're in it for the wrong reasons, as you know, many of the agents are, it can be awful.
Yeah, you mentioned so many good things there. And one of my favorite leadership qualities that you show is servant leadership. You know, you're never putting yourself above others. You're so willing to travel across country as the president of Athletes First for a charity event that I'm doing in Buffalo, New York, you know, on a Monday night, and travel all the way across the country. So what I've seen from you guys has been nothing short of spectacular in that sense. And this isn't a big sell for Athletes First. There's other great agents and agencies out there. But with my experience with Athletes First, it's amazing how many teammates I had that converted to Athletes First because they saw the commitment that you guys had for me. And this was early in my career. This was before I even signed a second contract. I'm on a small rookie contract and you guys were flying across the country. And I had teammates that were switching to Athletes First because they said, shoot, I want my agent to do the things that you have done. You mentioned Cameron Hahn, who I've worked closely with. And yes, it's more of a friend relationship when his son was the ring bearer in our wedding. and I got married at 26 in the heart of my career. And you also mentioned Savannah Wall, who I've known since college. And Savannah Wall this year signs a first round talent to Athletes First. So how incredible of a rise she's had within the company. And you guys have always done a phenomenal job. And you're now the president of Athletes First, and it's become the most powerful football agency in the world, representing 30% of the first and second round draft picks in the 2020 draft this year. What business lessons do you have for the listeners on scaling a business in any realm that they're in?
Yeah, so Eric, you probably remember this, but we started Athletes First in 2001, so we're coming up on our 20th anniversary. And when we started it, we were involved with all kinds of litigation. I mean, we started 2001. We didn't finish our litigation until 2006, 2007. And that litigation did not go well. You know, I mean, we were sued in state court, federal court, individual arbitrations, mediations. I mean, litigation, you know, galore. And at one point, we had a federal trial, which is almost unheard of. And we lost a $44 million judgment. And 20 of that was punitive. And we had no choice but to declare bankruptcy. That's the only way we could file an appeal. And we filed an appeal to the Ninth Circuit out here, you know, and that appeal was done by Mark Humanick, who you know, my college roommate, best friend, and former general counsel. Yeah, great bottle dance. And his wife, Laura, who's actually even smarter than Humes. And, you know, so we didn't have a chance. I mean, we had a 1% chance at best of winning that appeal. If we lost the appeal, Athletes First was over. Not only was Athletes First over, but, you know, we all couldn't never be agents again, and we probably couldn't even be lawyers again because of all the allegations. So we came down to that 1% chance, and, you know, miraculously, but, you know, I do believe the right decision, and we won that appeal, and we were able to settle the case after 6 or 7 years. And then, you know, starting 2008, we were able to really continue to build the momentum that we started during those 7 years. And so, you know, in terms of scaling the business, we went from negative $40 million and, you know, 1% chance of survival to where we are today. And I think for me, the key lessons is we developed a business plan, not even a business plan, we developed a philosophy, you know, a culture. And we never, ever deviated from that culture. You know, sometimes maybe you develop a culture, a business philosophy, whatnot, and it's not quite right, so you got to refine it. We got it right from the beginning, and it was really three principles. One, always put the athlete first, you know, no matter what's happening. Like, if Eric Wood's having a charity event in Buffalo and there's a way to make it, go, you know. And you know, the one thing, the one caveat to that, put the athletes first, but never get the family. You know how important family, Mackenzie and Brittany. And so if I had a soccer game or something like that, you know, I would go that. But, you know, always put the athlete first because it's a blessing to represent someone like Derek. It's a blessing to represent all of our athletes, whether they're first rounders or undrafted free agents, you know. And so always put the athlete first. That's the first lesson. Second lesson is do the right thing for the right people for the right reasons, you know. And that's what I kept telling everyone through our darkest days. Hey, listen, we're doing the right thing, you know. We're doing it with the right people, and we're doing it for the right reasons, you know. Like, this will work, you know. And when the $40 million judgment came back, I remember my staff coming to me like, hey, like, how is this working? You know what I mean? Like, this philosophy of yours is BS. Like, we got to change. We got to do something else. And I'm like, no. You know, when the clouds are the darkest, that's when you have to have the most faith, you know, both in your faith and in the business principles. So do the right things, the right reasons, right people, right reasons. And that's what we did. And we continue to do that. So every decision we make is this the right person for us to hire, to represent? Are we doing it for the right reasons? Are we doing the right things, or is the conduct right? And the other thing, which I think is super important, and this has really helped me personally as much as professionally, is, you know, in this universe, you give and you give and you give, you know, and then when the time comes that you need something, like we need to win that appeal, or like, as you know, when my house burned down, I need like all that stuff. Like, when you need something, and you will, right? We all need something. The universe is going to provide. And by universe can mean your faith. It can mean the universe, but most of the time it means, you know, more directly, your friends and family, your network and your community that you've built along the way. So whenever anything bad has happened to me professionally or mostly personally, the universe, the athletes first family, athletes first culture, the neighbors, they've been there for me and they've picked me up, you know, when I literally could not get up by myself. So those three things, athletes first, do the right things with the right people, right reasons, and you give and you give and you give, and the universe will provide. Those three lessons have guided us, and we've never, ever deviated from it. And then before you know it, we've gone from $40 million down to, as you said, the best draft class in our industry's history.
Man, that's phenomenal stuff. And I love the clear-cut vision, the fact that you can just rattle them off to this day. And that was, you know, you're probably talking about these 20 years ago. And to still to this day to be able to rattle them off. And often Bills fans will make fun of Sean McDermott because as we traded away all of the first and second rounders that anybody had ever brought to the Bills besides me, and they got rid of everybody, Sean McDermott just saying, trust the process. We have this culture here. And there's a lot of Bills fans that tune into this podcast that'll get a kick out of culture works in business and in football. And part of the reason is because when there's a clear vision, when everybody knows what's expected of them on a day-to-day basis, then it works. I had Scott Satterfield, the head coach of Louisville, on there talking about his core values. Whether it's core values, whether you call it a mission statement, whatever it may be, your company, your business, your team, your family need to be aligned and know where they need to get to in life. And I love that your vision is extremely clear. And I'll let the vision talk get to the goal talk. What are your goals for athletes first moving forward?
This is a great question, Eric. And it's a very before I answer that, let me tell you a quick story about Coach McDermott. You know, we go to Indianapolis for the combine every year, and we stay in the hotel and whatnot. And Cam and I, believe it or not, went to get breakfast one morning, and they have the great all-you-can-eat buffet, which we crush. But we're sitting there. We sit down next to Coach McDermott. I think Billy Beane was
Brandon Beane.
Brandon Beane was there. A couple other guys, and we just sit next to him. And we might have been a little bit tired from the night before. Not a lot of conversation, a lot of eating, but there's a lot of conversation at the Bills table, and couldn't help but overhear what they're saying. And I was mesmerized by what Coach was saying. You know what I mean? Like, he is talking culture. He's laying down the line. You know, I think this was his first year as a head coach. And, like, I was like, wow, this guy, like, I've never met this guy. Funny thing, I'd seen him working out that morning, and he worked out real hard too. But, like, I never met this guy. I don't know anything about him, really. You know, I'm a huge Patriots fan, so I don't have a lot of help for the Bills. But, you know, if he does half of what he's talked about, they're going to be successful. And so it's been really cool. I've never told that story. I've never told him that either. But it's been really cool watching him do, him, Brandon, everyone do what they said at that breakfast table. And it's working. You know what I mean? It's really cool. So Sorry for that side note, but
No, that is a great story, and Bills fans listening in will absolutely get a kick out of that story. And it's funny how spot on they've been with so much of their vision. And has everything worked out perfectly? Heck no. My first year playing under Coach McDermott, we traded for Kelvin Benjamin mid-year, and that was an ultimate flop. You know, they drafted Zay Jones early in the second round that year, a big flop at receiver as well for our franchise. Hopefully Zay goes on to the Raiders now and has a great career, but it hasn't all been perfect. But what they're doing and their vision, their culture they're setting up is absolutely phenomenal. But what are your goals for Athletes First moving forward? Yeah, so
this is a great question because, you know, we quite frankly, we've surpassed every goal that we set for ourselves back in 2001. And, you know, we have Athletes First. We have our sister company, Athletes First Partners in New York, that works with the NBPA. They work with the Retired Players Association in basketball. We're about to sign a deal with the United States Olympic Committee, just working with, you know, groups like the group licensing deals and whatnot. As you know, we've done a lot in the charity world. And so we are so far past our original vision. And the question is really now, you know, where do we want to go? We have a phenomenal minority partner, Dentsu, which is one of the largest advertising marketing agencies in the world over in Japan. And they've been phenomenal in terms of giving us as much capital as we need to build. And so, you know, I think we want to continue to build. And I think what we want to do is take our Athletes First philosophy and our Athletes First culture and expand to other sports, you know, and there's no reason why we can't do the same thing in baseball and in basketball and in golf as we have in football, you know. And you're friends with a lot of the athletes in other sports, and you know the negotiations, the different sets of rules, but it's still negotiations. But you know, 80% of what we do is what we've talked about here. It's the relationship, and I think that, you know, we just need to find the right people, the Cameron Hans and the Ryan Williams and the David Mulugetas and the Joe Panels of the baseball and the basketball world to, you know, do what we're doing here, you know. And we've also, another thing that we have started, and you'll see it coming out in June, is our first major deal with the Tua documentary, which will be on Fox, is we started our own content production company, like studio. And the reason for that is we really want to put the power in the hands of the athletes. So, like, if Eric Wood has a story to tell, it'll give you the power to create the story, control the story, right? Disseminate the story on one of the many platforms with which we have a relationship, whether it's Sports Illustrated or, in this example, Fox or NFL Network or whatnot. And then monetize the story for yourself, right? Because we got sick of seeing, you know, all those networks make so much money telling the player's story. And that's not the way it should be. It's your story. And again, I mean, there's plenty of money to go around. You know, when Fox is not showing the Tua documentary for free, you know what I mean? They'll make money off it, but you know, it's just a way to put the power back in the athletes' hands and put the athletes first. So to answer your question, a shorter answer, Eric, is we're looking for ways to expand our ability to put the athletes first in different sports and in different, you know, facets of the world.
That's great stuff. I love that you're adding the content stuff as well. What's next with Eric Wood will soon be an Athletes First underscore, and we'll get that rolling as well. But that's great stuff. And yes, it is. This model is absolutely scalable to other sports, because it doesn't matter if you're a basketball player, baseball player, golfer, whatever it is, you want an agent that has your best interests at heart that you can first and foremost trust. And then when you can have a great relationship with them as well, I always say, whether it's a financial advisor, whether it's an agent, whatever, they always say don't do business with friends. But I think it's a byproduct of spending so much time together, so many conversations, and you trust them that you're going to end up being friends. You know, it's not like I hired a buddy of mine from high school to be my agent. Yeah. We've just all become close friends, which is great.
That's why I'm laughing though, Eric. I mean, I think, you know, don't do business with friends. Knowing your buddies from Elder and from high school, I think that's great advice. I really do. I would not have hired them for anything, you know.
Okay, well, we just mentioned Elder, so I'll use this. Okay, so you come to Cincinnati and you recruit me and you go out to eat with my mom and stepdad and Cameron Honda, we've mentioned. You also came to the west side of Cincinnati to recruit another guy and Kyle Rudolph, had another late dinner and drinks with Kyle's parents and Cameron Hahn. Do you got to be careful when you come to the west side of Cincinnati for a recruiting meeting?
I think we have to be careful when we go to the west side of Cincinnati for any meeting, you know what I mean? And we're, you know, and Elder has some great football players come out of there. So thank God, God invented Uber, because back in the day, going to meet with the Rudolphs or going to meet with your family, you know, and that kind of goes back to the friend thing. Like, I remember going to meet with your family, and we're sitting down, and Cam and I are in a lobby and whatnot, and your dad says, "Hey, do you guys like beer at all?" We're like, "Yeah, beer's good." And so he's like, "Well, let's move this to the bar." So we're like, "All right, move to the bar." And both with your parents and the Rudolphs has happened. I mean, you know, we come stacked with information and these pamphlets and our history and all this stuff, talk about how great we are, that our team takes so long to put together and looks phenomenal. In both cases, we never open up the packets. You know, I don't think your parents or the Rudolphs had any idea who else we represented, that we actually negotiate contracts, anything, training, don't care. But I think that's the way to go, right? They trusted you to figure out who was competent, and all they cared about was with whom they were comfortable handing off their son, you know, because like your mom, your dad, I mean, up until that point, they've guided you so well and they've had their hands in everything. They kind of serve as bumpers to your life. But then when you start training for the NFL, they have no idea what to do, and nor should they, right? And so they have to trust someone else to be those bumpers. And, you know, I think you find out a lot more about people sharing a couple of drinks than you do going through, you know, this presentation. So, you know, kudos to both your family and the Rudolphs. So I think, you know, they were funny meetings, and they were long and they were fun. But they served the point. They got to know who we were. And I think it says a lot about athletes first, in particular Cam, that, you know, people from that part of Cincinnati really took to someone like Cameron, because he's, you know, he's salt of the earth, and he's exactly who I'd want representing my kids if they were talented.
Yeah, and the west side of Cincinnati, that we like our own, and you guys became part of our own. So a lot of being a sports agent is recruiting, and we mentioned this recruiting meeting. When you go to sign, who was your first guy you signed, and what was your recruiting pitch then?
So first guy I signed, will hit home for you and all those in Louisville. My first client ever was Chris Redman from Merrill High School and the University of Louisville, one of the best quarterbacks come out of that area. You know, and you've got a lot of them, Dave Ragon and Brian Brom and Stephon. You know, but he was my first client. But that's when I was with Steinberg, Moran, and Dunn. So I didn't really have a huge role in the recruiting pitch except to sit there and watch. But I think, you know, what Chris came out to California to visit for like a long weekend with Brad. He brought Brad with him. And, you know, we got a chance just to do barbecue and to go bowling. And I think Ben Francois took him golfing, and I kind of rode along in the cart and, you know, have a couple beer and whatnot and just get to know each other. And it was my first real experience doing that. And I was like, wow, this is the best job ever. Because this guy, Chris Redman, and his buddy Brad, like, the nicest people you could ever meet, you know what I mean? And I had such a good time with them. And, you know, I was much younger then. I was 29. So my wife was 29. We didn't have any, we had one, Mackenzie was not even 1 year old yet. But he came over to our small little apartment, and, you know, it was awesome. So that was my first client I ever had, you know, and to this day, it would be the most meaningful client I ever had for that reason. And we went through a lot together, you know. I mean, we had an awful draft experience where he got drafted a lot later than we thought he would. Third round, but still later than we thought he would. And then he won the Super Bowl as a rookie. So it's lots of ups and downs, peaks and valleys. But as you know, I mean, you know Chris as well as I do. He's just a phenomenal human being.
He is, and he has a 9-year career, and he's still the nicest guy anyone's ever met. I hear it all the time because I still live in Louisville, Kentucky. And the guy you mentioned, Brad Faulkner, now very, very successful himself, and still the nicest dude you've ever met in your life. It's awesome. I didn't realize Brad went out there. That'll be awesome, and he'll really enjoy hearing that on this podcast for sure.
I find it hard to believe that Brad's the same Brad who's successful today. I didn't think a lot about his future potential, but it's good to see that he's rebounded from that trip.
Well, you mentioned the golf course, and that's where a lot of deals on both their ends are done. They might be the only two guys in Louisville playing more golf than me right now. But so now it's a totally different sell. What's the sell to these top prospects you're getting now?
Yeah, and I, you know, I'm not going to correct you, but like, you know, I hate the word sell, right? Because you know, when, when you're selling something, it's you know, you're trying to get the sale, and then it changes, right? Like probably me and you back in our dating lives, or your dating life, I didn't have one, but you know, so I think that what we try to tell people when we go in is just listen, this is who we are, you know, and I think there's two factors to consider: are we competent? Can we do our job? And so we show them that we, over the last 20 years, we've done our job as well, if not better than anybody, you know, for 20 years, you know, starting with the largest deal in NFL history was our first contract for Drew Bledsoe, you know, and then going all the way to where we are today. But then, you know, it's just the comfort level, you know what I mean? Like, so are we competent? Yes. Are you comfortable with us? And do you, and part of that comfort, a lot of part of that comfort is trust, you know, and are we who you want to play a major role in your life? Because we're not interested in doing your contract and not talk to you for 4 or 5 years. You know, we want to come in, our whole team, and we want to welcome you into Athletes First family. We want to welcome your family to our family and ours into yours. And so if you're comfortable with that, which is something a lot, I mean, as you know, we have 32 employees now, which is far more than most of our competitors, and more than we need to just negotiate contracts and do marketing, you know? But we have that entire team, so we can do so much more. And if you're looking for that, then we're then hopefully we're the right one for you. If that's not what you're looking for, you know, like you said, if we're not your type of people, that's fine. You know what I mean? Because there's, like you said, there's a lot of good agencies out there. But we're a type of agency where, you know, we're gonna bring you into our family. We're gonna wrap our arms around you, and we're gonna take responsibility for every aspect of your life, and we're gonna give you guidance. And as you know, we're not always going to tell you what you want to hear. You know what I mean? It's sometimes you're going to give you the, you know, what we think is probably the best advice as opposed to what you want to hear. So that's really our pitch, you know, and it helps, I think, you know, your parents do. It helps that we can be completely transparent. We have nothing to hide. And we have the utmost confidence. And we truly believe that our team is the best team and our experience is the best experience. And we work, that's what we work at every single day.
Let's dig in a little on you as you personally now, a little less off of Athletes First specifically. What's the best advice you've ever been given in business?
Best advice I've ever been given in business. You know, it's probably when I was interviewing for my summer associate job with Ropes and Gray. And the person interviewing me became a great mentor. His name is Doug Meal, one of the best lawyers in the country. And as he started the interview, he said, listen, you know, are you a superstar? Because we only hire superstars. And, you know, at 19, 20 years old, it's a little bit uncomfortable. He's like 6'6" and piercing eyes and, you know, like looking right through me. And I'm like, am I a superstar? I have no idea. I really don't know what, you know. And, you know, after the interview went very well, and afterwards he gave me advice. He said, you know, never do anything unless you can be a superstar. It's not worth it. You know what I mean? Like, don't become a lawyer if you can't be a superstar. Don't become a sports agent. Don't become a dad if you can't be a superstar. Don't become a best friend if you can't be a superstar. Like, we all have the potential to be a superstar. Now, it's defined differently, right? Like, your definition of being a superstar athletically is so much different than mine. You know what I mean? And, like, your expectations of Gracie will be different than, you know, mine, you know, because we, you know, everyone has their own different genetics and potential and whatnot. But, like, you know, we all have our own definition of superstar. And the advice was, don't do something unless you're willing to turn the time and the effort, you know, to become a superstar.
I love that. Most successful people have a morning routine or a start to their day that sets them on the right track. What's your morning routine look like?
Well, right now in quarantine, it's a little bit different. You know what I mean? But, I'm old, Eric, so I don't sleep that much. So I'll get up at, you know, 5 a.m. First thing I'll do is respond to my emails and text messages for one reason, like to let my entire office know I'm up at 5 a.m. working, right? So that's the first thing I do. And then I get ready, go down to the garage, and I have a group like you do, a workout group, and we do TRX with these great trainers over in London. We do that from 6 to 7. Shower up, check in with the family, have breakfast, and then go to my office here and draw up my list of things, or review my list of things I had made the night before of what I want to do that day, and then get at it. And also, as you see in the back, I always, during the quarantine, I always light my Veluspa candle. You know, I think you know Troy, who created Veluspa in his garage, and he had a great initiative about spread the light. So I turn that candle, I light that candle, and, you know, it makes you feel really positive and really good.
You know better than most. If I didn't get my career-ending neck injury, how many years do you predict I would have played?
Probably at least 5 or 6 more. I mean, I think, you know, it's funny talking like you and Sully and Travis and all the guys, like, you didn't play a very hard position. You just had to hike the ball and let the guards do the work. So you could have played for a long time. No, at least
especially when I got good guards.
Yeah.
You know, playing between Richie and John Miller and some of those guys, it made it a whole lot easier towards the end of my career.
Yeah, I remember.
Craig Urbick was a great guard.
I remember talking to Travis Frederick and being like, man, like, all you do is make Pro Bowls. He's like, I don't know how. He's like, I snapped the ball and then, like, you know, but he's got Zach on the side and he got Tyron down the way. And, well, yeah, no, you would have played for a long time. You played as long as you wanted, Eric, you know, and it's one of those things, like, I, you know, literally one of the many times that this profession has brought me to tears, and, you know, Cameron obviously as well. Like, it's awful when you see something like that happen to such a phenomenal person, you know, and you are so important to the Buffalo Bills and that community. And, you know, it's funny when you ask me where I want to take athletes first, I think it's the same thing you're going through now, right? Your dream growing up was to be a football player, you know, and you did that at the highest level, and now you can't do that anymore, right? And so what are you going to do next? And I think what you want to do next is you want to do something with purpose, and you don't want to do it just to do it, right? Like, I don't want to do baseball and basketball just to do baseball and basketball and make more money and whatnot. I want to do it because it's the right thing to do, going back to that. And so it's, you know, I think in that regard, both you and I are going through the same thing. We don't have those answers, you know, and sometimes we have to draft someone or make a decision that, you know, doesn't work out, but we learn from it. And, you know, that's when it's nice to have someone like you and Cameron and Mac to, you know, talk about and then try to figure that out, what we're going to do next.
No doubt. If you could add one person in the world that's still alive to your current quarantine situation with you and your immediate family, who would you add and why?
So I might be the only person, you know, Eric, who loves quarantine, you know, and I hate the situation. I hate the financial situation. I hate all the, you know, health, you know, bad health and deaths going on right now, but I'm loving quarantine. I don't miss the airport. I don't miss the hotel. I don't miss the travel. I quite frankly don't miss my friends right now. You know, it's, I got my wife and my two daughters and I'm loving it. But if I had to, I mean, if I was going to add one person, I had the opportunity, I'd add my wife's grandmother. She's 96 years old. She's in St. Louis. She's in an assisted living situation, and the virus found its way in there. And so she's really been, you know, in her room by herself since February. Oh, she had an operation right before that. So, like, since February. And at 96 years old, like, that's hard. You know, you need that interaction. You need the physical therapy. You need just seeing other people, you know, and she doesn't have any interaction beyond the telephone. So, you know, while it would be somewhat dangerous to have a 96-year-old, you know, living in our house, if you say that I could, you know, protect her, then I'd bring her here and, you know, make her life a lot better. And I'd love to have my daughter see their great-grandmother and my wife see her grandmother. So that would be ideal.
That's the most touching answer we've had to that question, for sure. If you couldn't do what you do for a living right now as a sports agent, president of Athletes First, what would you want to do if you could do anything?
All right. So this is going to assume that, like, I hit the lottery or something like that, right?
Because anything you want.
Yeah. Because I'm not going to, I mean, I do enjoy all the benefits that being a sports agent brings to me. But if I had unlimited money and I couldn't be a sports agent, my dream in life would be become a teacher. You know, I love to be elementary school teacher, maybe middle school, also teach gym, you know, like do the soccer thing that I used to do. But I love teaching, you know, and I love, it goes back to having an impact on people. Like, people that age are so incredibly, you know, susceptible to influence, and they have so much to learn, and they're just being shaped. And yeah, I love that. Actually, the number one person in the Harvard Law School class, when he graduated, he moved back to Ohio and became a 7th grade teacher and the basketball coach. And he was a terrible.
Wow.
Yeah. So I always, that always stuck with me, because I'm not sure why he paid, you know, $150,000 to go to law school and go back to be a seventh grade teacher. But, yeah, no, I think that would be great.
Yeah, I'll never forget you telling me at one point when I was about to have kids or maybe after Grace was born that the best experience you ever had in your life was coaching your girls in soccer growing up and how much fun you had, you know, coaching their teams. That will always stick with me. What's your favorite book?
Oh, man. So I love to read. Love reading. Probably my favorite book, and it became like a series, is Pillars of the Earth. It's by Ken Follett, and it's a trilogy. Very complicated to read. I had to like make cheat notes to keep track of all the families and whatnot, but just a fascinating tale of many, many generations and how, you know, what happened, you know, 100, 200, 400 years ago still like resonates in our families today.
That's really interesting. I'll have to check that one out. All right, we have a few rapid fire questions. What's your favorite restaurant?
Pizzeria Regina in Boston, North End.
Quick answer, and I love it. The guy knows what he likes. What was your first car?
The Murph Party Mobile. It was a Caprice Classic station wagon that my dad handed down to me. And it was great. I thought it had like a secret compartment in the back. It turned out it was just like the trunk, but we used to like hide beer there all the time, going on Cape Cod. And I think we were very stealth, but yeah, that thing was awesome. All kinds of great life experiences in that station wagon.
Yeah, I've heard stories of people with station wagons putting kegs in the back. I had buddies in high school that would do stuff like that. I never partook, of course. this is going to be tough for you based upon the amount of clients you've represented, but who's the most famous person in your phone?
Well, you, of course, but that's probably not.
So that's not true.
The most famous person on my phone is actually not a client at all. It's Miley Cyrus is in my phone.
Wow.
My guess is that her number has changed since then, but I keep it in there to show off to like my nieces and nephews and whatnot. But I think you remember that. We did a big Christmas party for all the homeless children in Orange County. And Miley Cyrus, when she was Hannah Montana, was kind enough to host it with me. And then we did the Starkey Foundation event out in Minnesota with Kyle Rudolph, and Miley Cyrus was honored. So I got to go to two events with her and managed to get her phone number in my phone. It's probably changed since then, and I never used it, but I keep it there for clarity purposes.
Yeah, absolutely. Get some street cred off of that. And yeah. Quickly, you mentioned a couple of the different charities that you've participated in recently, but you've won a couple of different Man of the Year awards based upon your philanthropic efforts. I've learned so much from you in just the area of being generous in general. You're so quick to be generous with your time, your talent, your treasure, always giving. Where does that spirit come from?
My best friend in the world, Greg Payne, we grew up since second, third grade, and that's his spirit. I mean, he is to this day, he's 51 years old, and he's still an advocate for the homeless. I mean, he's been a homeless advocate his whole life. His goal is to eviscerate homelessness. He went to law school to become more effective at it. That's what he does. He's brilliant. He's fluent Chinese. He got all kinds of offers from big banks, and he turned them all down to work for the homeless. And he has taught me that since third grade. And all the work that I've done is like a drop in a bucket, a drop in the ocean compared to what he does. So all anything that I do to give back is his influence.
That's really great to hear. What was your first job?
I never really liked to work for anyone else. So my first job was actually with Greg Payne. We started our own landscaping company called Neighborhood Lawn Maintenance. And our slogan was, go to the beach, leave your lawn to us this summer. And we were god awful, Eric, like awful. We did my buddy Craig D'Ambrosio's lawn. And they were gone. We did it for 2 weeks and came back and went to get paid. And he brought us outside. He's like, what'd you guys do? I'm like, what do you mean? He's like, you ran over all my mom's flowers. You didn't do the backyard. You hit our fence leaving. Like, what? Like, why? How? Like, oh, we didn't notice that at all. We thought we did a great job. We were terrible, but we ended up having like 50 lawns, and we got my brother and his friends to mow a lot of them. We subcontracted it out, so it was a good job.
That's awesome. What's your favorite movie?
Being from Boston, it's got to be
Good Will Hunting.
Yeah. Yeah, I mean, you probably thought I was going to say Rudy, and it's not too far behind, but, you know, Rudy, I knew the real Rudy, so it kind of takes away from that movie. So, Good Will Hunting, yeah, for sure.
I met the real Rudy at the Independence Bowl this year. It was sponsored by Walk-On, so they had Rudy come out to be Rudy, the ultimate walk-on. They had him come out, so I did have the chance to meet him this year as well. Murph, I can't thank you enough for your time today. These podcasts I've done during this COVID time, I'm doing them completely unsponsored. If people have in their heart and they want to donate, what's a charity that's close to your heart? And I'll attach in the show notes a link to that foundation.
Yeah, thank you for the opportunity. And I've actually changed my mind on this one. Like, you know, it's don't thank me, Eric. Like, this is awesome. I mean, it's awesome seeing what you're doing post-career. It's, you know, you've been so meaningful to Athletes First and to me and to Cameron and to my family. And, you know, I'm so proud of who you've become. And I think, you know, anyone who's listening to this did not tune in to see Brian Murphy, but they're listening to you. So I think, you know, any donations that anyone has, you know, desire to make change or whatnot, you should provide a link to the Eric Wood Foundation, because that's you're doing some incredible work. I love what you're doing. And I think most of the people listening to this are huge Eric Wood fans. And I think, you know, what you and Leslie are doing for all your communities in Louisville and Buffalo is awesome. So provide that link. I'll make a donation, and hopefully anyone listening will make a donation, and we'll go from there.
Wow. That blows me away, Murph. And honestly, it doesn't surprise me. Thank you so much for your time today. Thank you for all your words. Thank you for the impact that this is going to have on so many people's lives, brother.
Hey, man. Love you, dude. It's great to see you, and look forward to catch up in person when this is all over.
Yep, absolutely. Love you too, brother.
Bye, man. Talk to you soon. Thanks for the time.
Yep. See you, Mark.
Thank you for listening to What's Next with Eric Wood. I hope you enjoyed the show. If you did, please rate it 5 stars and subscribe. That goes a long way for us with this podcast. Tune in a couple weeks for another new episode.